Good morning. It's Monday, June 29th. We're starting the week with a branch that's finished, but closed. A look at why Staten Island's 90s secession movement is the perfect mirror for our current political fracture. And a reality check on the longevity industry. We've also got updates on the AI sector's transition from hype to infrastructure. The final curtain call for Aqueduct Racetrack. And a breakdown of why your kids' travel baseball team is actually a $28 billion tax on your sanity. Here's the thing about our infrastructure. It's only as good as the people who aren't getting in the way of it. We're starting today in the Midwest, where a $6 billion piece of infrastructure is currently serving as an expensive monument to the power of political patronage. The Gordie Howe International Bridge is officially finished, but it isn't open. According to reports on the project, the U.S. federal government is blocking the opening by withholding the necessary staffing, effectively keeping the crossing closed. The reason for this bottleneck? The bridge is a direct competitor to the Ambassador Bridge, which is owned by the Marone family, a group that happens to be major donors to the Republican Party. It's a classic case of a private monopoly protecting its turf at the expense of everyone else. Right now, 4 million trucks a year are forced to navigate through 10 different traffic lights and inefficient inspection plazas on the older route. All of that idling and delay is, for all intents and purposes, a hidden tax on the North American supply chain that gets passed down to consumers. It's a pretty shitty situation when a public asset, fully funded by the Canadian government, is effectively held hostage because a private family doesn't want competition eating into their revenue. Beyond the immediate economic drag, it sets a dangerous precedent for future infrastructure projects. If the federal government can just pull the plug on an international agreement because some donors are annoyed, why would anyone want to invest in a public-private partnership in the future? It's a massive institutional risk, and frankly, it makes the whole system look like a joke to our neighbors to the north. Moving to the East Coast, a recent episode revisited the Staten Island secession vote of 1993 to explain why the political landscape feels so fractured right now. The Forgotten Borough wasn't just a catchy label. It was a symptom of deep-seated regional resentment. Residents felt abandoned by a Manhattan-based power structure that didn't represent their interests or values. Because that alienation was left to fester, it created a vacuum that politicians like Rudy Giuliani and a young Donald Trump were able to exploit to build their own coalitions. The takeaway here is that when a group feels like the central government has stopped listening, their commitment to the social contract doesn't just stay stagnant, it decays. They stop seeing themselves as part of a shared civic identity and start viewing their neighbors as antagonists. The reason this matters today is that the Staten Island situation wasn't an isolated event. It was a diagnostic tool for exactly where we are now. If a democracy doesn't find a way to integrate peripheral voices before they reach that point of total alienation, you end up with a population that isn't just frustrated, but actively looking to dismantle the structure itself. It's a reminder that grievances don't just vanish if you ignore them. Finally, let's talk about the latest shift in the longevity movement. Research indicates that the shingles vaccine might reduce dementia risk by 20 to 24%, a concrete finding that anchors a broader shift away from billionaire-funded fringe immortality quests toward a more grounded focus on health span. We're seeing a split here between two very different approaches. On one side, you have the high-tech speculative crowd looking at full-body organ transplants and AI-driven biological age measurement. These are the people who seem to think they can outsmart biology entirely. But as the research points out, there's a real ship of Theseus problem there. If you replace every part of yourself to keep the machine running, are you actually still you? It's an ethical quagmire that doesn't have a clean answer. On the other side, there's a much more grounded, practical approach that's actually backed by data. The hierarchy of effective interventions is remarkably boring, which is probably why people try so hard to avoid it. Deep sleep, strength training, a Mediterranean-style diet, and maintaining actual human connections. It turns out the best way to live longer isn't a secret billionaire hack, It's just the stuff we've known we should be doing for decades. The real danger, according to the latest analysis, is the obsession itself. When you treat your life like a math problem to be solved, you end up sacrificing the present for a hypothetical future. There's a specific kind of perspective and peace that comes with aging, a capacity for observation that you just don't have in your 20s. If you're so busy trying to optimize your biology that you're miserable, you're missing the whole point of having more time in the first place. You don't want to spend your life optimizing for a finish line that you're too stressed to enjoy. Longevity should be about staying in the game long enough to remain observant and useful, not just avoiding the inevitable. Speaking of things that are supposedly going to save us, let's look at the tech sector. The industry is in a weird place right now. We're in an involuntary pause, frontier model releases have slowed down, and the hype cycle is hitting a wall of regulatory and development hurdles. But looking at the latest reports, this lull is actually acting as a forcing function for maturity. The industry is shifting from efficiency AI, which is really just a fancy way of saying make the same stuff faster, to opportunity AI. The goal now is to build things that were previously impossible. For individuals, that means moving away from the bot-sitting tax. You know the drill, spending hours manually priming an AI for a task, then doing it all over again the next day. The push is toward building portable context assets. Instead of relying on chat interfaces, the move is toward formalizing your workflow into structured formats or model context protocol servers. It's about building a persistent knowledge base so you aren't just a glorified prompt engineer. For organizations, the message is equally skeptical of the status quo. If a company is announcing AI-driven layoffs, pay attention. That's often just a mask for routine, post-pandemic restructuring. When leadership frames AI as a threat rather than a tool, they destroy the psychological safety required to get honest feedback on how these systems are actually performing. And honestly, if you see a company claiming they've rapidly transformed their entire business model through AI, they're likely just performing for the market. Real integration requires changing how people interact across silos. And that shit is inherently slow and difficult. Meanwhile, Baidu is making a massive pivot. They've moved from a traditional search engine to a full-stack infrastructure provider, integrating their own custom silicon, cloud platforms, and physical autonomous taxi fleets. They've stopped measuring success by daily active users and switched to daily active agents. The logic is that humans have limits: sleep, distraction, time zones, but agents can manage e-commerce or logistics 24/7. Baidu is also changing the sales pitch. They aren't going to CTOs anymore, they're going to CEOs with a revenue-sharing model. If they can prove their agents are creating measurable operational improvements, they want a cut of that value. It's a gamble that AI will eventually be treated as a utility, like electricity, where you pay based on the work it actually finishes rather than the volume of data it touches. This shift toward agent-based infrastructure creates a systemic risk known as understanding debt. We're seeing a shift where agent swarms generate and verify complex hardware designs, bypassing expensive proprietary software. It makes chip design faster and more accessible, sure, but it also creates a competence-performance asymmetry. Here's the thing. If an agent builds a circuit that works, but the human engineer doesn't understand the underlying structure, you've created a fragile system. You lose the ability to debug the anomalies when things eventually break. We're trading deep technical mastery for surface-level prediction. When you stop performing manual implementation, you lose the intuition required to design the next generation of systems. You end up with these massive bloated AI-generated codebases that nobody on the team actually understands. That's a breeding ground for systemic failure. Ultimately, the takeaway across these reports is pretty consistent. Stop looking at the press releases and start looking at the infrastructure. The companies and individuals that are actually going to make it through this aren't the ones obsessed with the latest, loudest model drop. They're the ones building reusable systems, forcing themselves through manual training cycles to keep their skills sharp, and prioritizing concrete business outcomes over performative tech mandates. If all you're doing is consuming tokens to do the same work you did last year, you're just paying an AI tax to stay in the same spot. The real work is in the architecture, not the chat window. Everything else is just noise. And speaking of things that are just noise, let's look at the track. Aqueduct Racetrack has officially closed its doors, marking the end of a specific, somewhat brutal era in American horse racing. For decades, the track was defined by its inner circuit, a mile-long stretch of pea gravel and salt that was notoriously hard on horses. Jockeys like Richard Migliore have noted that the track's design was so idiosyncratic that it required a kind of manual labor and local knowledge that pure athleticism couldn't touch. It wasn't just about how fast a horse could run. It was about knowing how to position them to avoid the kickback that came off that surface. It's easy to romanticize the tactical environment of a place like Aqueduct, but reading through the history, it sounds like a nightmare for the horses. You had riders hoarding secrets on how to keep mounts from faltering, and an audience that held everyone, from the jockeys to the trainers, to a standard of performance that bordered on hostile. But there is something to be said for that kind of accountability. When you take away a venue that forces riders to actually understand the mechanical properties of the dirt they're running on, you lose a certain level of craftsmanship. We're left with a cleaner, perhaps more standardized sport, but it's hard not to feel like we've traded away a bit of the game's actual substance. Shifting gears entirely to the betting windows, if you're looking at the late pick four at Assiniboia Downs, the math is changing. Because the pool carries a $50,000 guarantee with a $1 minimum stake, the usual strategy of spreading your money across a deep ticket is a quick way to go broke. The goal here is discipline. The advice is to stop betting like a hobbyist and start betting like a scout. In the fourth race, the recommendation is to fade the morning line favorite, the 7, because its outside draw is likely to be a death sentence against the inside speed. Instead, look at the 5, East Coast Cowgirl, specifically because of the trainer's 25% win rate in second off the layoff starts. By the time you get to the 5th, it's a wide open field, so you're looking at Silver Spice for consistency, but maybe taking a flyer on the 4, Brown Light, at 15-1. The 6th race is about boring, reliable form. Stick with the 2 or the 6. Then, for the finale in the 7th, if you're looking to actually cash a ticket, consider Big Ticket at 25-1 as a high-variance play, while leaning on Lieutenant Norm, who's getting a notable jockey upgrade. The takeaway here is pretty simple. The higher minimum bet is a feature, not a bug. It forces you to actually look at trainer patterns and jockey switches rather than just throwing money at the favorites. It's a colder way to play, sure, but it's a hell of a lot smarter than betting on a hunch. If you think that sounds expensive, wait until you hear what's happening to youth sports. Youth baseball has officially morphed into a $28 billion industry. It's no longer the neighborhood park pastime. It's a high-stakes, pay-to-play consumer product. As top talent migrates away from local leagues toward private travel circuits, it creates a vacuum that leaves community programs hollowed out. Families are now locked in what's effectively a baseball tax, trading retirement savings and limited time for the hope of a college scholarship that statistically is a total long shot. We're seeing a clear demographic shift where the sport is becoming a luxury good, prioritizing commercial growth over actual development. And frankly, the physical toll of overspecialization on preteens is a disaster waiting to happen. Moving to the NBA. The league's new collective bargaining agreement is forcing front offices to treat their rosters like high-frequency trading portfolios. Teams like the Charlotte Hornets and Oklahoma City Thunder are hoarding draft capital and prioritizing cap flexibility to exploit the second apron restrictions that have hamstrung traditional contenders. We saw this play out in the recent deal between Charlotte and Phoenix. The Hornets picked up an unprotected 2033 first-round pick from Miles Bridges, while the Suns gave up their future equity for a marginal, immediate upgrade. The middle ground of contention has become an analytical death trap. If you aren't a championship-level team, burning your future for a maybe is a great way to stay stuck in the mud for a decade. The league is also struggling to balance the math with the optics. We've seen mid-tier centers and productive role players getting traded simply to shed salary. And internal front office friction, like the recent messy discourse around Jaylen Brown's statistical profile, proves that teams are still trying to figure out how much weight to put on data versus the eye test. The takeaway is simple. If you aren't managing your roster as a liquid asset, you're already behind. Finally, in the 2026 American Athletic Conference football season, the market is betting on the wrong horses. Analysts Sean Green, Ryan Kramer, and Colby Dant suggest that betting markets are mispricing teams based on brand name rather than the reality of roster turnover. Programs like South Florida are carrying high win totals, 8.5 to be exact, despite massive portal churn and a first-time head coach. The analysts argue that's a massive miscalculation. In a landscape defined by chaos, continuity is the only real edge. Teams like Army, which are returning starters and keeping their coaching staff intact, are being undervalued. While the rest of the conference tries to install rhythm-based air raid offenses that get shredded by the triple option, the stable programs are the ones actually positioned to win. It's a reminder that in modern college football, the most expensive roster isn't always the one that functions. And for the rest of the business and economic outlook, here's what's on the horizon. The next jobs report is scheduled for Friday, July 3rd. Economists are looking for a modest bump of 110,000 positions, with unemployment holding steady at 4.3%, and hourly earnings ticking up by about 0.3%. If those numbers land where they're expected, it suggests the labor market is in a Goldilocks phase, not too hot, not too cold. But that's a big if. Pantheon Macro has already flagged that initial and continuing jobless claims are trending upward, which hints at a softer reality than the headlines might suggest. If payroll growth misses the mark and drops below break-even, the Federal Reserve might have to pivot toward accommodation, which honestly would be fascinating to watch, because it would essentially mean the stock market starts ignoring the actual state of the economy entirely. Then there's the situation in the Strait of Hormuz. Following U.S. strikes against Iranian infrastructure in June 2025, the outlook for shipping has turned grim. Prediction markets have already dialed back expectations for a quick return to normal transit. This isn't just about regional politics, it's a classic supply-side shock. As hostilities drag on, insurance premiums and transit costs are going to climb, which is going to push global energy prices up, whether the U.S. labor market cools off or not. The real headache here is the math. If you get a spike in energy costs at the same time the labor market remains tight, the Federal Reserve's soft landing starts looking more like a pipe dream. It's a shitty intersection of variables, and the market is clearly nervous about how these two forces are going to collide. On the corporate side, all eyes are on Nike's Q4 earnings. The sentiment is split, and frankly, it's a bit of a mess. You've got the optimistic crowd looking at the current stock price as an entry point for long-term gains. But the bearish case is looking a lot more grounded. It centers on structural rot, specifically wholesale channel resets and a glaring lack of innovation in their 2027 pipeline. If Nike misses their targets or gives weak guidance, it's not just a bad quarter for one company. It could be a signal that the era of premium valuation multiples for the entire retail sector is effectively over. If that happens, investors are going to have to do the hard work of rethinking growth expectations for consumer discretionary stocks across the board. It's a lot of pressure for one sneaker company to carry, but that's the reality of a market that's been running on vibes instead of fundamentals for a while now. Anyway, the bottom line is that we're heading into a week where domestic signals are likely to be neutralized by global chaos. It's hard to get a clear read on the economy when the data is pointing in one direction, while the price of oil and the risk of further conflict is pointing in another. We're in that weird high-stakes gap where the primary danger isn't any single event, but the way they're starting to feed into each other. If you're looking for a smooth ride this week, you're probably looking in the wrong place. And to keep yourself from losing your mind while you wait for that ride to get smoother, let's look at how we're working. High-achieving professionals often rely on chronic stress to power their work. But research suggests this reactive high cortisol approach is fundamentally inefficient. The fix, according to recent analysis, is shifting from vague, nebulous goals to a system of specific, actionable tasks performed in distraction-free blocks. By borrowing proven strategies from others instead of reinventing the wheel, you can bypass the friction of trial and error. The goal here is simple. Stop identifying as a stressed person and start acting as a problem solver, using clarity rather than raw endurance to maintain velocity. On the physical and mental health front, Ido Portal argues that our obsession with discipline is actually holding us back. Portal suggests that modern life conditions us toward a narrow, low-resolution existence. Think algorithmic feeds and rigid exercise, which makes our internal models brittle. The alternative is high-resolution awareness. By treating daily life as a curriculum rather than a series of obstacles, you can leverage neuroplasticity to develop genuine resilience. It's about navigating contradictory states, like holding both pain and pleasure during exertion, rather than defaulting to binary black-and-white thinking. Finally, there's the persistent gap between what we say we want and what we actually do. Most of us are walking around with a massive perception gap, fueled by defense mechanisms that hide our own behavioral patterns. The solution proposed is a daily awareness diary, a simple, consistent set of questions answered over 2 weeks to create a data-backed audit of your actual life. It's a sobering exercise, right? You realize pretty quickly that your biggest hurdles aren't a lack of effort, but the contradiction between your stated goals and your daily habits. At the end of the day, you can't fix a problem you refuse to accurately measure. Before we wrap up, a few other things worth knowing this morning. First up, if you're one of the 7 million people currently on the SAVE plan, the clock is officially ticking. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act just dropped, and it's forcing a total overhaul of federal student loans. You've got 90 days to pick a new repayment option, or you're headed straight for default, which honestly is a hell of a way to treat people trying to pay their bills. On a lighter note, linguists are pointing out that our family vocabularies are basically just childhood mispronunciations that stuck. Whether it's calling hot dogs, go dogs, or M&M's LMNOPs, we tend to codify these mistakes as permanent shorthand. It's a good reminder that language isn't some rigid rulebook. It's just a messy feedback loop of whatever we happen to say at the dinner table. In the world of comedy, there's a move toward intentionally alienating the mainstream to build a bulletproof niche fanbase. By leaning into erratic, cartoonish personas, pros are finding that being too much for the general public is actually a better business model than trying to please everyone. It's a nice reminder that if you aren't pissing someone off, you probably aren't doing anything interesting. And finally, if you're looking at colleges with acceptance rates under 10%, stop acting like your transcript is a golden ticket. These schools are playing a game of institutional Tetris, filling seats based on their own internal priorities rather than just merit. So please, save yourself the heartbreak and actually apply to your safety schools. It's brutal, but that's the reality of the process. That's a lot to hold on to for a Monday. Stay observant, keep your system simple,